And good afternoon, Scott Spears along with you on this Wednesday, November the 14th, 2018, 14 minutes past the hour. You're tuned into the Now program, and today is going to be a very special hour. We are joined for the hour by a gentleman who has never been on this program, but we are so pleased to have him here today. Now, let me tell you a little bit about this gentleman. His name is Ben Ferenz. He's 99 years old, and Ben was an investigator of Nazi war crimes after World War II and the chief and last living prosecutor for the United States Army of the Nuremberg Trials. And for those who don't remember, the Nuremberg Trials, the trials of the group of Adolf Hitler and the Nazis in World War II. What an honor and privilege and pleasure it is to welcome to these microphones for the first time, but I hope not the last, Ben Ferenz. Ben, how are you?
I'm fine, Scott, considering the alternatives. I'm in my 99th year, and I don't think I'm immortal, but I'm still hanging in there.
Well, Ben, I wanted to start right there. What's the secret to live to be 99?
I never stop working, and I am working for something which cannot be achieved in one human life. What I'm really aiming for is to put a stop to war making. It's just too plain stupid, and it costs too many lives. And my Nuremberg experience taught me that you can have people who become murderers because their country is at war. And I had the opportunity to try 22 defendants among the Nuremberg trials. It was run by the United States. And they were accused of murdering in cold blood over a million people, including thousands of children. And I proved that beyond any doubt whatsoever. When I was 27 years old, I had been a member of the United States Army as a combat soldier when we went to war against Germany. I had seen the horrors of war firsthand, but in ways which very few people survive. And I was dedicating the rest of my life to trying to do what I could to prevent it from happening again. And that's what I've been doing. And so when I get a call from Scott Spears of Marion, Ohio, wherever that is, I say, sure, you want to talk about this? Okay, let's talk about it. Do you have any questions? Let's go.
And let's go. Ben, I want to start back because you had a very interesting childhood. Tell us about your childhood.
Well, I was born in Transylvania. Now, nobody knows where Transylvania is because it doesn't exist anymore. You heard of Dracula. That's my uncle on my mother's side. It's fiction. I was born in a little village in what, when I was born, was Romania. My sister was born in the same house a year and a half before. She was born in Hungary. It was the same place. And I learned that it doesn't matter what you call the country. It's how you treat the people that counts. And in both cases, Hungary and Romania, as far as the Jews were concerned, they treated them so badly that I suggested to my parents, let's get out of town. And 9 months later, we sailed for the United States of America. And conditions were such, we sailed third class, of course, on an open deck, because there was no fourth class. And we arrived in New York with no money, no friends, no language, no skills which were saleable. And my father was able to get a job as a janitor for a house in Hell's Kitchen in New York, and we were allowed to sleep in the cellar. And that's where my life in America began. We sailed past the Statue of Liberty. We have never forgotten. The lamp burns brightly for refugees. It did then. And, well, that's how my life began. And I was very fortunate. I went to school in my eighth grade. Teacher called my mother in. My parents had been divorced because they had been married before they were born. They were arranged marriage by their parents. And said, this is a gifted boy. I didn't know what she meant. I never had any gifts. And my mother didn't know what she meant, but the principal said this boy should go to college. I didn't know anybody who went to college. Well, to make it a little bit shorter, I not only went to college, I wanted to become a lawyer. I applied to the Harvard Law School, which was the best law school in the world. I won a scholarship on my first exam, and I was graduating from the Harvard Law School when the war broke out. And by that time, I had made up my mind that I wanted a career in crime prevention, because everywhere around me, it was criminals. And so that was my career goal. And the biggest crimes were those being committed by the Nazi government. They had also adopted the program of murdering all the Jews on the theory that the Aryan race was superior and shouldn't be contaminated by Jewish blood. And so it was the government policy to kill all the Jews, men, women, and children. That sounds incredible to people who don't know it, but it was the absolute truth. And there was the big International Military Tribunal trial against Hermann Göring, who was the survivor Hitler committed suicide. That was followed up with the British and the French and the Russians had joined with the Americans to try the well-known Nazi leaders. That was followed by a dozen subsequent trials run by the United States trying to give a broader picture of what it was like. How could a civilized country like Germany engage in the type of atrocities and cruelties which they did? And so we, the United States, the Pentagon, decided that we would have another 12 trials to show what the doctors did in connection with medical experiments, what the lawyers did, sentencing people for political reasons, what the SS did. These were the murder squads who carried out the executions, usually, foreign ministers, etc. And anyway, to make it short, since your program, I assume, doesn't go on forever, I was assigned, when the war was over, I was discharged as a sergeant of infantry. And I was already a lawyer and law degree and had passed the bar, but the Army figured they could use me to clean the latrines, which is what they gave me to do. They gave me every dirty job they could possibly give me. But I survived all the battles. I landed on the beaches of Normandy. I went through the Maginot Line and the Siegfried Line, and I crossed the Rhine on a pontoon bridge driving a jeep. And the final Battle of the Bulge took place in the Ardennes Forest. I was there. Mm. And anyway, I was invited by the Pentagon to go back to Germany. I didn't want to go back to Germany. And they made it very tempting. They said, look, we'll make you a full colonel. They would promote me from sergeant to colonel. And I said, in the Army, I don't go. They said, we'll make you give you a simulated rank. I said, what does that mean? That means that you get all the privileges of a full colonel, and you can quit whenever you want. I said, now you're talking. So I called up my then girlfriend, to whom I've been happily wed for now 73 years without a quarrel, and I said, how would you like to go to Europe for a brief honeymoon? She said, I'd love it. This is so sudden. So we were wed, and off we went to Germany. And my assignment there, the first assignment, was to collect evidence against the suspects whom we had already arrested in the Nuremberg jail. And these were top people. And if you have the criminal but no evidence, you've got nothing. And if you've got the evidence and no criminal, you've got nothing. So I had to match the suspects being held with evidence which I had to collect. And so I set up an office in Berlin, and there we soon uncovered something which has affected the rest of my life. And these were reports from the Eastern Front. As the Germans attacked Poland and Russia and Ukraine and went on, they had organized special squads called Einsatzgruppen. Now, the word Einsatzgruppen is a German word. Literally, Einsatz means action. Gruppen is groups. It was designed not to reveal what their assignment was. Their assignment was, and we had the minutes of the meeting of that as well, to kill without pity or remorse every single Jewish man, woman, and child they could lay their hands on. And they did. And they reported on it. As they advanced into Poland and into Ukraine, they reported daily from the front how many Jews they had killed in which towns. And I had the name of the commander, and I had the name of the time, and I had the name of their top secret report, which was consolidated in Berlin. There were four different ABCD units, about 1,500 men altogether who were engaged in that. They were consolidated, and 99 copies were distributed to other people in the German hierarchy, the Nazi hierarchy, and I had the list. And I sat down with a little adding machine and began to add up. When I reached 1 million people killed, I stopped, I took a sample, I flew with it from Berlin down to Nuremberg, which was our headquarters for these subsequent trials. I presented it to the man in charge of that, General Telford Taylor, who we later became law partners in New York. And I said, "General, we have to put on a new trial." He said, "We can't. We have already assigned all the lawyers. The Pentagon is not very enthusiastic to begin with. I can't now come in with a new trial all of a sudden." And I said, "You can't let these mass murderers go free." And he said, "Well, can you do it in addition to your other work?" I said, "Sure." So he said, "Okay, you got it." Mm. And so I became the chief prosecutor for what was then and still is the biggest murder trial in human history.
Ben?
At this point, we might pause if you have any questions.
Yeah, I want to go back a little bit here before we get to the trial. You were touring the concentration camps after World War II. What?
Well, let's not refer to it as touring. I was no tourist. As we liberated the concentration camps and we saw what was happening, we did send a report into headquarters that there's some people coming out of a camp. It looks like they're all ragged. What do we do? Okay, I jump into my Jeep. I'd head for the camp. The first one was Buchenwald. And I'd get there as fast as I could because if you waited 2 or 3 days, everything was destroyed. And the Americans had just liberated the camp. And I'd come in there and collect evidence of the crimes by heading first for the offices where they kept their records, seize all the records, and then proceed to get witnesses and other accounts to support a trial. So I was not a tourist. I was there working under very difficult circumstances because there were dead bodies all around the place, and crematoria were going, piles of bones in front of them, people who were so thin you couldn't tell they had been human, and the stench in the camps of the death was everywhere. Every disease was in the camps. The people were behaving like rats, digging in the garbage for a morsel of food, stop their starvation. These were the conditions. So pardon me if I object to being called a tourist.
No, I totally understand. You know, when you entered, what was the, it seems like a silly question, what was the atmosphere like? It just had to be horrible.
Chaos. It was chaos. Dead bodies lying all around the ground, some of them stirring, their eyes pleading for help, SS trying to escape, running out, some of the guards, some of the inmates chasing. We had Russian prisoners of war as well. The Russians were in pretty good shape, and they'd grab a gun and start chasing them, sometimes catching them. I've seen them. They catch them and burn them alive. I've seen that too. Beat them to death. So total chaos in the camps. Stench, you know, noise, dirt, everything, everybody running in different directions. And, well, that settled down after a couple of days, of course, but that was the initial reaction.
What kind of records did the people who ran these camps keep?
God bless them. Leave it to the Germans. They kept very direct records, very accurate. Unfortunately, they kept many copies. And let me tell you a little story, if we've got time. One of the clerks, one of the inmates who was in the office where they kept all these records, when he saw me coming, he said, "I've been waiting for you." He said, "Come with me." And he took me out to the electrified fence, and he dug up a box which had in it the photographs and a little sort of a passport for every SS, the stormtrooper guard who'd been in the camp. And when these cards expired, they'd issue a new one. He was supposed to destroy the old one. He didn't destroy it. He saved it. That would have cost him his life if any of the SS men had caught him saving it. And he said, "Here, this is for you." And I had from him, the inmate who risked his life 100 times, and he hands me this box, and I've got a picture of the every SS guy who was in the camp, his rank, when he was at the meeting, etc. And that, of course, was priceless evidence, so that no one in that camp would ever be able to deny that he'd been there, which, of course, they tried to do.
Mm.
But it showed that even in desperation, there was still hope there would be a day of liberation, and I was it.
When the Nuremberg trials started, what was the atmosphere like?
Well, the big Nuremberg trial against Goering and some company was the Germans felt it was victor's justice. They were not interested in the trial. Their sympathies still remained with the Nazis who had brought them to that condition. The Allied covered it extensively on the press. We had a visitors gallery, but no Germans were there, very few. All in all, the Germans said, "Well, this is what happened. We lost the war. They're punishing us for losing the war." They didn't draw any more severe consequences or recognize how it had come about, that they were living in ruins and facing hanging.
What were the particulars of your trial? Who were you trying, and what was the crime?
I was trying 22 defendants whom I selected from a list. I had the roster of about 3,000 men. And, of course, I had to make sure they were in custody before I tried them. So we had a list. I would canvass the POW, the prisoner of war camps, and I selected those of the highest rank and the best educated. So I had about 6 or 8 generals, SS generals, and many of them had doctor degrees. And my lead defendant was a man by the name of Dr. Otto Ohlendorf. He was the father of 5 children. His unit killed, according to his written reports, 90,000 Jews. And when asked to whether that was correct, he said no, he didn't think it was correct. Why not? Because the men sometimes exaggerated the body count. But it could have been 70,000, 80,000. And he boasted that he was trying to be more humane than most. He didn't allow his men to smash the infant's heads against a tree, but he required that they aim for the mother who was hugging the infant and then shoot both of them with one shot. And he was otherwise rather a gentleman who made an argument which was recently made by the United States president, much to my surprise, my unpleasant surprise. Dr. Otto Ohlendorf said he did what he did in self-defense. So what do you mean self-defense? Nobody was attacking Germany. He said, "Well, we know, but Hitler knew that the Russians were planning to attack us. And therefore, it was our duty to strike first, and that's what I did." And he produced many German legal opinions that was lawful. And it was this preemptive first strike on which he based the fact that he therefore had to kill everybody who might be a possible enemy. Well, the judges, 3 American judges, led by Michael Musmano of Superior Court of Pennsylvania, said that's not the law at all. It would be a terrible law if you could go out and just kill your neighbors and his friends because you thought he had a gun and might use it against you. They said, that's not the law, and it doesn't make sense, and it's a crime. And they sentenced him to death by hanging. And I spoke to him, the only prisoner I spoke to one-on-one before he was hanged, and he hadn't changed his mind. He would do it again. He didn't feel he had done anything wrong. Now, what peeved me was when the President of the United States, Mr. Trump, in his first appearance before the UN General Assembly, made the argument, speaking to the head of North Korea, he said, "If we are threatened by you, we will totally destroy your country." That's his words, language, and I heard that. I was watching it on TV. Totally destroy the country of North Korea. Mr. President, how do you totally destroy a country? Do you go and kill everybody in the country? Do you drop a nuclear bomb on them? And because you think you're being threatened, you think you can do that? It was for that that I arranged to hang Otto Ohlendorf by the neck until dead, which took 8 minutes, according to the report. And the President of the United States is making a similar argument. I felt rotten, is the way I felt, because the argument was unsound. It was unsound by Ohlendorf, and it was unsound by the President of the United States. And I'm not talking politics. It was unsound. And so we repudiated what we tried to enforce at Nuremberg. And as the chief prosecutor responsible for that trial, without me, it would never have taken place. I felt rotten.
Mm. You know, I saw an interview recently with the late Albert Speer, who was who worked for Hitler, was a German architect, and apparently was there when Hitler killed himself, and also was on trial and was imprisoned for a time, but he didn't spend life in prison. And his explanation for why the Holocaust happened, why he did what he did, was I was just following orders. That was the answer. Do you believe...
That was a common answer used by German soldiers. That was the first response, just following orders. That was a lie. It was not true. They all had also a Zollbuch, they call it, also like a little passport, which gave them the rules. And it said they had to obey all lawful orders. They can't tell me that they think shooting 1,000 children is a lawful order. So they were required to obey lawful orders. Let me come to Albert Speer, because he was particularly interesting to me. His assistant was sentenced to death, his deputy, and he was given life in prison, 20 years in prison. I visited him when he came out of Spandau prison. I arranged to meet with him secretly at Frankfurt Airport, and I said to him, Speer, I am bringing action against German industry, IG Farben, Siemens, Krupp, AEG, every big German company, because they put up the money to build the concentration camps, and they worked the people to death. That was their assignment. Instead of just killing them outright, as the Einsatzgruppen were doing, it's better to, since we need them for war production, to work them to death. And I said, they all say that no, they had the same working conditions as workers, they were forced to do it, they had no choice, and they come with all those explanations of why they didn't think it was criminal to have slave laborers working for them. And I said, how do you explain that? And I was afraid he's going to say, hey, boy, I already served my time. Get out of my way. I ran that risk. But he'd written several good books while he was in prison, bestsellers. And I gathered from what he wrote that he had some remorse. And so I said to him, how do you explain it? He said, they're lying. I said, well, I'm just writing a book now for Harvard University Press on called Less Than Slaves, because the workers were less than slaves, and they were being worked to death. You're a slave, you try to preserve them. I said, and they tell me that they had to do it, they had no choice, and how do you explain that? He said, they're lying. I said, well, look, I'm going to give you the manuscript of this. If I want to be absolutely correct, if there's anything I said which was in any way wrong, please mark it, and I will change it. And I gave him the manuscript of the book. And on every page that was relevant, he marked Einverstanden, agreed, 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 agreed. So there's a guy whose life was saved, not logically, because his deputy was executed, who really showed some remorse, at least a willingness to acknowledge the truth. And Albert Speer, he served 20 years in Spandau Prison in Berlin, and which is subject also to Russian control, which was nasty when they got their turn. And it also reflected something else. War makes murderers out of otherwise decent people. All wars. And that's why my aim has been, stop war making. It's just too stupid. What happens today, and it's still happening today, is when the head of one state can't agree with the other one, what do? They send young people out to kill people on the other side, people they don't even know, people who may never have harmed them. They didn't even know where the country was. They kill each other until they get tired of killing. Then they each declare victory and they rest for a while. Then they start again. And then they spend all their money for more weapons to kill more people. Can you imagine something as stupid as that? That is the current practice by the United States of America and the other countries of the world, the other big powers. That's the current practice. And the people they send out, I hope some of your young people listening say, hell no, we won't go. This is too stupid. You should spend the money not on guns, to more ammunition, cyberspace weapons to kill more people. You should use that money to pay for the college kids going to school. You should use it to pay for the sick and the old. You should use it to build new schools and new ethics of human behavior. Instead of that, they send it to build more guns to kill more people. I can't imagine anything as stupid as that. So the result is that here I am, close to 100 years of age, and I'm still working on trying to change it. And we are changing it slowly. We do have an international criminal court. Everybody said to me, Ben, don't do it. You'll waste your life trying to get an international criminal court. I said, I know, you may be right, but it's the right thing to do. We cannot have law without a court to enforce it. And I'm going to try. And I spent most of my life working to get an international criminal court. Finally, they had a court. And finally, they had a guy on trial who was seizing kids and converting them into child soldiers, which is a war crime. And the chief prosecutor, Marino Ocampo of Argentina, called me one day and he said, Ben, we'd like you to do the closing statement for the prosecution. And I said, okay, I will. So there we had it. I had been the chief prosecutor of the Einsatzgruppen, which was the biggest murder trial in human history. I was 27 years old. When the court finally had there, and they had their first trial on, I did the closing statement. I think I was 95.
Mm. Ben, so, that's a good span.
It means never give up. Yeah. That is my slogan, never give up.
Never.
And I've been living by that all of my life. I say that just law, not war, is a slogan to follow. Law, not war. It's a peaceful way of settling disputes by peaceful means only. And never give up, never give up, never give up. And if your readers or listeners can take that message home with them, this broadcast would have served its purpose as far as I'm concerned.
Well, Ben, I want to go back here, and I think you're right. I want to go back to the trial when you were 27 years old. When you were trying these men who were Nazis, mass murderers, what was the most interesting thing you learned or heard throughout that trial?
Most interesting thing was the fact that nobody was prepared to get up and say, okay, I'm guilty. On the contrary, they felt that what they were doing was their patriotic duty, and they would do it again, and said so. There was one who really got me annoyed. Normally, this trial was very quiet. Everybody spoke quietly. There was no emotion shown on any side by anybody, including me. But this one of these mass murderers, he says, what? Jews were killed? I hear it here for the first time. Well, my God, I had his reports how many thousands of Jews he had murdered in different places. I felt like jumping over the podium with a bayonet and put it in one ear and push it out the other. He has the gall to stand there and say, here's it for the first time. That was the only emotion that I ever felt, you know, during the trial itself.
You know, Ben, I want to come back to Albert Speer for a second, because one other thing I heard him say in this interview I watched, and I think he said it in one of his books, was that they asked him, why didn't he stop Hitler? Why didn't he object it? And he said, right, out of fear. He was fear that Hitler would kill him.
Well, Hitler was very popular. He was elected by a majority, and he had a good technique, which people follow. You pick an enemy, the Jews, blame all your troubles on them, so you got somebody to hate, and then mobilize them and say that you are the most powerful and can be the most powerful, and therefore you will reassert your proper role as a leader of the world, and that has a great appeal to a lot of people and a lot of countries, including the United States.
When you were going through this trial and dealing and meeting with people who knew Hitler personally, what did you learn about the man? Did you learn anything about him?
Well, of course you learned something about him, but if you know the inner feelings of the man, he had been a corporal like me in the First World War. He was disgruntled. He was a rabble-rouser as a speaker. He had a technique of lying, but make it such a big lie that they couldn't check it, and repeating the lies and having other people repeat the lies. All in all, he never was married. He had the mistress, Eva Braun, who stayed with him to the end. They both committed suicide together. And he was a kind of a rabble-rouser who could arouse the people who could be easily misled. People are gullible. If the head of state tells them something, they think it's true. And he blamed it on the Jews and the communists, and if they weren't in existence, Germany would have been the most prosperous in the world. They never would have had a depression, so they have to rearm and assert their power again, and that appealed to the public. And in the end, of course, they realized, well, I hope they realized, that it cost them their lives, of millions of people.
Why the Jewish people? Why was that his group?
It's such a convenient target, because their Jews were scattered. They didn't have a homeland of their own, of any kind. They were roaming people coming from different countries. My own family from Hungary, Romania. These were all Catholic countries whose part of their adherence to their own faith was to turn their backs on anybody who had a different notion. And the causes of war, as I've ascertained, the first cause is religion. People are ready to kill and die if they think their faith is being challenged. The second cause is nationalism, their country above all. Ours is the greatest, keep them the greatest. And thirdly is the economic circumstances. So here Germany had economic depression. They could blame it on somebody else. They had a feeling of nationalism. They could call Germany as the greatest. We are the greatest. Make us great again is probably what they said in another language. And their basic religion was to pick on a minority somewhere which can't defend themselves and try to exterminate them. So that's the way it worked. And it still works that way today, unfortunately. So my focus is to try to change the hearts and minds of people so that they will recognize we are all inhabitants of one small planet. I wrote a little book called Planethood, and we must share the resources on that planet so that everybody can live in peace and human dignity, regardless of their race or creed. In fact, I didn't ask for the death penalty for any of my 22 defendants whom I proved had murdered over a million people. And the reason I didn't ask for the death penalty was there was no way you could have a scale of justice balanced, 22 people killed for murdering a million people. But I thought if I could get a rule of law which would protect people in the future, the people that they were murdered, they were killed because they didn't share the race and the religion or the ideology of the executioners. And I thought if I can change that so that everybody is entitled to protection of law, regardless of his race or his religion or his color, then it would have been something which would be of permanent value to everybody and not just take the revenge on these 22 defendants. And that's what I asked the court to do, and that's what the court gave us. And I must say, since that time, I've, of course, been working on the same problem. I have received many awards. The most recent one was celebrating Eleanor Roosevelt and the writers of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We had the Bar Association inviting Elizabeth, Mrs. Clinton, to join with me and receive an award. So it's something which I have dedicated my life to, creating a more humane and peaceful world, which is what we need if we're going to have it. But it's a tough going. So I accept invitations from places like Western Ohio, wherever you are, Marion, Ohio, to try to get that point of view across.
You know, Ben, in the final 10 minutes we have here, when you look at the world today, what do you see?
I see a world torn with strife. It breaks my heart. We have people all around the world are killing themselves. I mean, if you take a thing like Rwanda, 800,000 people, black people all, one group fighting against another group and killing 800,000 people in a couple of days. And I met the ambassador of Rwanda at the United Nations not long ago. And we were at a meeting, and she was one of the people attending. And I was introduced to her, and I said, look, I want to apologize for what happened in Rwanda. And she said, why? And I said, well, we should have known that it might happen, and we did nothing to stop it, and I think we all owe you an apology. But she was so impressed by that that she began her address by making reference to the fact that I'd come up to her to apologize. Well, I feel that way. That these murders that are taking place in all parts of the world, it's because we have failed to inculcate feelings of brotherhood and feelings of compromise. It's not cowardice to compromise, and it takes courage not to be discouraged. And people have to be prepared to recognize that and move on to the peaceful resolution as is required by law. It's required in the United Nations Charter and the Universal Declarations of Human Rights. Everyone is entitled to a fair trial and to live in peace and human dignity, regardless of his race or creed. And that was my pitch when I was 27, and it's still my pitch when I'm 99.
Well, Ben, we both live in the United States. How do you think things are here in November of 2018?
How do I think? What, our fear?
What do you think things are like in the United States in 2018?
Things in the United States are similar as they are in elsewhere. The public is divided. They have always been divided. There are people who believe in settling disputes by power, and that's the only thing that it really counts. We have, for example, the chief legal advisor, John Bolton, through President President of the United States, and he says there's no such thing as law. We don't need an international court. We shouldn't have it. The international court is dead, and it's dying, and it should die, and that is the position he takes. I don't take that position at all. I take the opposite position. I don't think that he, and he's the advisor to the president. He's not the advisor of me. We have this division within the country. The country believes the president when he makes his speech. They believe the other people, even if they're lying, and they lie very frequently. So they're divided between those who believe in a peaceful resolution of conflict and those who believe in power, like John Bolton. And the result is you end up with a war and millions of people killed, because they've been unable to accept it. Rule of law, and law, not war. It's a simple thing, law, not war. You would save billions of dollars every day. You could take care of the needs of the children and the schools and the sick and the aged. If you just accepted going to a court instead of trying to kill everybody who had nothing to do with it. Crimes are committed by individuals. They're not committed by ISIS or Shmisis. They're committed by people, by individuals. You want to sort them out as being criminals for starting wars? Sort them out. You want to kill them? You can kill them. But you don't blame a whole people for crimes committed by a few leading individuals. That's what we face in the United States today and in other countries as well.
For somebody who faced the Nazis, put them on trial, and has lived in that time as an adult, do you have any fears today in the United States?
Yes. I certainly have fears. I fear for the younger generation because I know that we have the capacity today to kill everybody from cyberspace. We have the capacity, it's not generally known, it's no longer a military secret, I can talk about it. We have the capacity to cut off the electrical grid on planet Earth. And not only we have it, but the Russians have it, and the Chinese have it, and I don't know who else has it. That being so, what happens if they decide to cut off the electrical grid on Washington or on Ohio? Cut off the electrical grid. How long would it take for everybody in Ohio to be dead? I put that question, not to regarding Ohio, but the general question, to a general who was dealing with this problem. He said, well, he wasn't aware of any studies, this was several years ago, have been made of that subject, but his opinion was that it would depend upon how much water they had. If they had water, they could probably survive for a week. If they didn't have water, they would die sooner. That is the state of the world today. It scares the hell out of me. Now I'm 100 years old almost, because it just lets loose again with from cyberspace. It's, the nuclear weapons are already obsolete. We just don't know what to do with the waste. It's much worse than the nuclear. So the young people face the threat of really getting involved in a conflict which gets out of hand, and they get out of hand. And somebody decides, let's hit them with something from outer space, where the Russians happen to be cooperating with the United States quite well in outer space. The Russians want me on a broadcast, I think, tomorrow. And we'll deal with that. But to answer your question, it's scary today because the public is deceived. They don't like to hear about it. They're busy with the ball. Kids are busy with the ball games and with the dancing as it should be. But the thoughtful ones, I hope, will recognize that law is better than war no matter what. And even if you had a bad decision, it would be better than war. And so you've got to stop the illegal use of armed force and recognize that it's a crime against humanity, a crime against all of humanity, and it should be triable in any court in the world. Whoever is responsible for starting the illegal use of armed force deserves to be put on trial and penalized for it.
What do you make of President Trump?
Of who? Mr. Trump?
Yeah, the president.
Well, I don't want to get caught up in political things, but I'm very disappointed in the president. I would not have voted for him. I don't want to mislead anybody. But the president has been making so many mistakes and has shown an arrogance and which I haven't seen it in presidents before. And so I think he needs guidance. I think he's been a terrible president thus far, frankly. It's my personal opinion. People are free to disagree. I welcome that. He doesn't seem to realize the power that he has and the danger that we're in. The taking of children away from their parents because they didn't comply with immigration regulations is a crime against humanity. This is a horrible thing to do. For the United States of America, I think of the Statue of Liberty, send me your homeless, your people yearning to be free, to take children away from the mother and separate them because they didn't comply with the immigration regulation. It's a shame on the United States. It's a shame. And that's what I feel about it. And I think those responsible should be removed from office. Because that's not a humane way. We are a humane country. It's a great country. I've given back to America everything I've ever gotten. I will go out of this country a pauper. I will return everything back to the country. But when we have things like that happening, I'm ashamed.
Mm. You know, Ben, the 99 years you have lived, what have you learned by being in these experiences, living in the time now, being a part of the Nuremberg trials? What have you learned?
I have learned that it's a great world. I've learned I've been a very lucky guy. I said 73 years married to the same woman without ever having had a quarrel. My kids are all well educated. I got rich from being poor. I will be poor when I go out. That's my determination. And it's a great country, a land of great opportunity. But because we are a great country, we have divergences of opinion, and that's as it should be. And some of the people don't believe that you can have a peaceful world. They believe in the power rather than that. And that I can trace that back to Thucydides and the Peloponnesian Wars. And then after the First World War, the generals believed a little more power, we would have won, and so on. So there are differences of opinion, and I'm sorry about that, because some of those opinions may cause us the life of everybody.
Ben, before we part ways, and this has been a fascinating discussion, when we go back to the World War II era and we go back to the Nuremberg trials and the people you tried, when they were giving the answers that they didn't feel they did anything wrong, do you, and I guess it's just an opinion, do you believe they thought that or they were saying that because they were on trial?
No, they were sincere in their belief. Ohlendorf, whom I say, I went down to see him in the death house. And I wanted to give him a chance to go back on the bad argument he'd made that there was self-defense, and he stayed with his argument. But he was a man who believed that what he was doing was his patriotic duty. His country felt threatened by somebody else, and therefore, as a good German, what he has to do is be ready to fight and die if necessary for his country. And the same thing exists for all the different religious groups that are fighting with each other. The so-called terrorists, you know, if we had time, but there was a time when I was being the target of terrorists who were determined to kill me. And the ones who were determined to kill me and the group of other people were those who were ready to negotiate with the Germans about compensation for the victims. And the people in Israel said, "What do you mean? You're going to get money for people who killed my parents? You dare to sit down with these Germans and talk to them about money? Have you no shame? We'll kill you all." And they tried to kill us all without too much success, without some success, but they didn't kill me. And the leader of the group was Menachem Begin, who was elected president of Israel and won the Nobel Peace Prize. So be careful who you call a terrorist. And people feel strongly about their opinions, and they're ready to kill and die for it. And I'm trying to get it to change, to say you have to be tolerant and you have to be ready to compromise and find a acceptable solution without having that kind of a violent ending.
We've been chatting with Ben Ferenz. He was an investigator of Nazi war crimes after World War II and the chief and last living prosecutor for the United States Army at the Nuremberg trials. Ben, I hope you come back so we can continue the conversation. Thank you so much.
Before you leave me, you can put down my website. It's Ben Ferenz, B-E-N-F-E-R-E-N, F-E-R-E-N-C-Z, excuse me, I'll give you my website, www.benferenz.org. Everything on there is free. Radio, lectures, books, articles. Take it, use it. If you agree with it, spread the word. It's yours.
Thank you. Ben Ferenz, thank you so much. You stay well.
You too. Bye-bye.
Ben Ferenz, how about that? For this day, this is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
There was a very short time a commercial where I greeted him because he was the marshal some years ago. Any day parade, isn't it? Where